Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who examines the collapse of Enron and the enormous influence the company purchased through millions of dollars in campaign contributions. Bill Goodfellow of the Center for International Policy, who analyzes the Bush administration's controversial appointment of Otto Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. And Michael Dolan of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses protest actions being organized to greet delegates of the World Economic Forum as they gather in New York City at the end of January. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review magazine reports that a new high-stakes energy standoff could be building in Central Asia, with the dismantling of the Taliban regime and the placement of American military bases throughout Afghanistan. Major oil companies like ExxonMobil and British Petroleum are updating plans to exploit the 80-billion-barrel energy reserve in Central Asia. These plans include taking a new look at several pipeline projects, including one that would go from the ex-Soviet republics through Afghanistan towards Pakistan. According to diplomats and energy executives in Asia, such a move could upset Russia and China and raise the global profile of border disputes between Iran, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan to Cold War dimensions. An oil analyst in the energy-rich Caspian Sea noted, soon the U.S. will be playing a major role in these disputes. The September 11th terrorist attacks put all talk of oil development in Central Asia on hold. The heated conflict in Kashmir also has had negative consequences for new projects. But expectations are changing. Energy exploitation will soon be back on the agenda, with the general feeling that Central Asia has been neglected for too long. It will be the third time that the great powers have tried to play the great game over the fate of resource-rich lands of Central Asia. Growing up, Cambodian family planning advocate Hen Satha, now in her 40s, did not learn much about abortion until a friend in high school suddenly died from an illegal procedure. Later on, Satha witnessed a lot more suffering working as a midwife in a refugee camp on the Thailand-Cambodian border. According to the news magazine In These Times, conditions have recently improved in Cambodia, where abortions were legalized in 1997, and there is a growing focus on improving women's health. Yet these gains could be lost in the wake of President George Bush's gag order that stops U.S. funding to international groups that provide abortion counseling. Health workers in Cambodia now admit it is very difficult to talk to our clients about abortion services. To complicate the situation, Cambodia is now in the nexus of a major public health crisis, with an exploding HIV/AIDS infection rate, growing infant mortality, and the percentage of pregnancy-related deaths among women that is among the highest in the world. With little access to safe abortions, many Cambodian women are turning to cheaper alternatives such as traditional midwives who try to kill a fetus with her fingers, or use the Chinese pill, a homemade remedy that often results in hemorrhaging. With aid now cut off by the Bush administration, pregnant women are suffering the consequences in Cambodia. Just last year, 2,000 Cambodian women died from unsafe abortions. Mother Jones magazine reports that Utah oilman Earl Holding is looking to strike gold during the Winter Olympic Games. As owner of the Snow Basin Ski Resort, Holding won a $14 million contract to hold such high-profile events as the men's and women's downhill races. Holding has also won several other lucrative concessions from the U.S. government. The federal government agreed to pay for a road going from his ski resort to the Salt Lake City Airport. In addition, Holding used the upcoming Olympics to win a 1,300-acre land swap in 1996 that will allow the resort owner in years to come to build luxury condos, hotels, and a golf course. Holding started pushing for a land swap in the mid-1980s, but was turned down by the U.S. Forest Service. With the Olympics coming, he won the backing of top Utah Republican Congressman James Hansen and Senator Orrin Hatch, who put the land swap into the 1996 public lands bill. In the process, Holding gave Hansen and Hatch tens of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. The land swap and Holding's manipulation of the Winter Games has Utah residents grumbling and asking tough questions about government corporate corruption and influence peddling. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The recent collapse of the Enron Energy Corporation, the single largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, has provoked many questions about who knew what and when in the Bush administration, as the company's chairman contacted key government officials in the weeks before Enron failed. But while the White House says no favors were given to Enron, many employees and small investors were financially wiped out, as the company's top executives, aware of Enron's dire situation, avoided losses by selling their stock worth $1.1 billion. The connection between the Bush administration and Enron are many. Kenneth Lay, Enron's chairman, was among the top political contributors to Bush's presidential campaign. Vice President Dick Cheney sought Lay's advice in secret meetings to formulate the administration's energy policy. Attorney General John Ashcroft, a recipient of Enron campaign contributions, was forced to recuse himself from a Justice Department investigation into Enron's collapse. And President Bush recently chose Mark Roskow, a lobbyist for Enron, to chair the Republican National Committee. While Republicans received about 73% of Enron's $5.8 million in political contributions since 1989, Democrats, too, have benefited from the energy giant's quest to buy influence. Among the latest revelations to surface was the admission by Enron's accounting firm Arthur Andersen that it destroyed thousands of documents related to the bankruptcy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Larry Noble, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who examines the collapse of Enron and the investigations now underway to determine the extent to which political corruption played a role in this monumental business failure.
Well, from a campaign finance standpoint, it's a good case study of what is happening in Washington and around the country. What you have with Enron is a corporation that had become a moderately big player in the political field, giving out campaign contributions, trying to buy access with those campaign contributions, and it would have probably continued doing what it was doing if it had not run into this major problem of a bankruptcy. And what that bankruptcy has done is really shine spotlight on Enron and also the contributions it's given, and frankly has a lot of politicians running for cover right now.
In terms of Enron's connections with the politically powerful in Washington, D.C., they've been most closely identified with the Bush White House, but they've certainly given out tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to Democrats as well. Maybe you could speak to the kind of player they were and the kinds of influence that they tried to acquire with all these campaign contributions.
Well, it's interesting. Enron was not the top political player. In fact, it's in the top 50 of, if you look at corporations and labor unions in terms of donations, they're in the top 50. And that's important to keep in mind because what we're going to discuss about Enron in many ways is going to be true about a lot of corporations. And it just gives you some insight into the political process. Since the 1990 election cycle, Enron has contributed about $6 million to political candidates. Now, many corporations give to both Republicans and Democrats. Some tend to lean one way or the other. Enron has given to both Republicans and Democrats, but about 73-74% of its money has gone to Republicans. It has also been a big supporter of President Bush's campaign. And Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, was also a supporter of President Bush, both back in Texas and once he came to Washington. And, in fact, it goes even beyond that. Vice President Cheney had an energy task force which met, and it's become somewhat controversial since they refused to release the details of the energy task force. But the reports are that Enron or Ken Lay met with the energy task force about six times. So, and this is the task force that was deciding energy policy for the United States. And that's some of the stuff that you get to buy with your political contributions.
As we look to Congress to investigate the Enron collapse and the political connections there, who among Democratic leadership also received contributions from Enron who may be a little less than honest brokers in looking into the scandal?
Well, there are a number of people. You can start with the Texas delegation. Ken Benson, a Democrat from Texas, received was actually the largest recipient between 89 and 2000, receiving money from Enron. Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas also received a lot. And she's a Democrat. Martin Frost, a Democrat from Texas. Now, it's not surprising, frankly, to see that they first help out their home state people. On the Senate side, you have Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who's a Republican, and Phil Gramm, who's a Republican. If you go down, though, the fourth largest recipient of Enron money was Charles Schumer from New York, who received almost $22,000 in Enron money. The problem is the political contributions that start the process, and whether people are thinking because of those political contributions, I've got to come down extra hard, or because of those political contributions, I've got to lay off, the problem is the political contributions are going to impact the process.
Now, when it comes to the congressional investigation, optimally, what would you like to see come out of it in terms of maybe some precedent-setting changes in the way America does business or the oversight process of, through the Securities and Exchange Commission?
One of the things I would like to definitely see come out of it is a full and complete investigation. And this may be too much to hope for in an election year, but one that isn't just driven by partisan screaming back and forth, but are really, really getting to the bottom of this. I think some of the issues that are going to be on the table include Arthur Andersen. I mean, we haven't talked about that, but there's obviously, it's coming out in the news every day, Arthur Andersen destroyed documents. What did Arthur Andersen know? What's the relationship of these accounting firms that also do consulting? Are they really independent auditors at this point, or are they just merely consultants who become flacks for the companies? There was an attempt in the past to regulate these type of firms, and in fact, Arthur Andersen had lobbied against that, and they won that lobbying battle. I think you're going to see a real cry now to regulate those type of businesses. There's obviously going to be a real look into investments. Retirement investments people make in their own company, and there's some talk about limiting how much an individual can put or how much they can invest in the company that they work for, because here you see what happens, or the danger of what happens. It's be interesting to see the effect this has on President Bush's call for privatization of Social Security. Here you see some of the dangers that brings about. So I think it's going to. I think in the end, hopefully, it will start a debate about this whole issue about privatization, about what should be done with these retirement plans, and also about corporate responsibility, what the responsibility of a corporation is to its shareholders, to its workers, and what the responsibility of accounting firms like Arthur Andersen is.
That was Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Contact the center by calling area code 202-857-0044. Or visit their website at www.opensecrets.org. Last week, President Bush made a recess appointment of Otto Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Bush had first announced Reich's appointment last March, but ran into intense opposition among Senate Democrats. Among the reasons they were opposed was Reich's tenure in the early 1980s as head of the Reagan administration's Office of Public Diplomacy, where he worked directly with Oliver North, producing propaganda to influence U.S. public opinion in support of the Contra War against Nicaragua's Sandinista government. 3 years later, his office was closed down by Congress as an illegal operation. Reich, a Cuban-American with many ties to anti-Castro groups in Miami, later served as ambassador to Venezuela, where he wrote letters in support of a visa application for Orlando Bosch. Bosch is a convicted terrorist who is responsible for the bombing of a Cuban airliner in which 73 civilians were killed. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Goodfellow, Executive Director of the Center for International Policy. He discusses why Bush appointed Reich, his lack of support in Congress, and some of the important regional issues Reich will be responsible for in his State Department post.
Reich's record was so notorious. Most of us who follow Latin America were just amazed that the administration would put him forward. And a number of times, this has been going on a long time, his name surfaced February 15th in the Washington Post. And on the 9th of March, the New York Times did a large expose of Reich that would have sunk any candidate, linking him to all sorts of misdeeds in the past. And it looked like his candidacy was over, but astonishingly, they kept him in there. And then finally, on the 12th of July, Reich's name was formally sent to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In other words, he was formally nominated. But most people at the time realized there was no way this guy was going to get through. The Democrats were adamantly opposed to him, in particular Senators Biden and Dodd of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But I think there was consensus in the Democratic Party. And a good number of Republicans, including Republicans on the committee, also opposed Reich. So it was just clear that he wasn't going anywhere. In fact, Senator Dodd refused to hold hearings until the administration provided the documents that he was asking for, which is pretty much normal procedure. Reich's, even his personnel file from the State Department, has never been provided. So the administration completely stonewalled the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on this. And then what happened is it looked like back in September, Reich was going to, his nomination was completely stuck. It wasn't going anywhere, and it looked like he was going to withdraw. Then what happens after September 11th, the administration's approval ratings soar, the president's approval ratings soar up to around 90, and Otto Reich decides to make one last push for it. The administration was really feeling its oats, felt that, well, if the Senate doesn't confirm him, we'll just do a recess nomination. I think they made that decision back in the fall and just went right ahead. And in fact, it became part of a larger political strategy to try to depict the Democrats as obstructionists.
How long can he serve with this recess appointment without ever being confirmed?
Well, there's some question about that. He can serve without a challenge from the Democrats. He can serve through October, at which point he could continue either as acting assistant secretary, or there's nothing to prevent the administration from making yet another recess appointment. Now, there is a provision that would allow the Democrats, with a simple majority vote in the floor of the Senate, to remove him. There's not much precedent to that sort of thing. More likely is that the policy just stays deadlocked for another year, which would be really a tragedy for Latin America.
And what do you think are some of the issues or policies that the Bush administration is interested in promoting in Latin America that Reich would be their man to do that?
For one thing, they are pushing for what's called fast-track authority for a regional free trade zone, and they certainly need the Democrats for that. And I don't think they're going to get much Democratic support if Reich is the one trying to get them on board. Democrats are very bitter about this, and so I think they can just kiss fast-track authority goodbye as long as Reich's there. I think some very important issues are the war in Colombia, which is spinning out of control. The larger drug war doesn't seem to be going particularly well. Argentina's financial situation seems absolutely dire. And there's talk of a coup in Venezuela. So there's some very important issues in Latin America that need to be addressed and need to be addressed in a bipartisan manner. One issue that is a clear problem is U.S. relations with Cuba. No country in the hemisphere, not even Canada, backs the United States embargo. In fact, Canada is a major trading partner with Cuba. And Otto Reich comes out of, he's Cuban-American, and he comes out of this hardline Cuban-American exile community in Miami that is intent on forcing an uprising in Cuba, strangling the island in the hope that the U.S. Marines will restore the properties to the Miami owners, the original owners. And it's a policy that's not supported by the American people and not supported by anybody else in the hemisphere. And this is the passion of Otto Reich and his supporters. What's really happened here is that foreign policy, sound foreign policy, has been sacrificed for political objectives. Otto Reich's nomination has nothing really to do with foreign policy. It's all about domestic politics. It's a payoff to the Cuban Americans in Miami who rallied behind George Bush for his presidential election and whose support his brother, Jeb Bush, will need this fall for his reelection for the governorship. So it's foreign policy as sort of taking a backseat to domestic political concerns.
That was Bill Goodfellow, Executive Director of the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. From January 31st to February 4th, more than 1,500 corporate leaders and their political allies will be gathering in New York City for the meeting of the World Economic Forum. The annual meeting, held in Davos, Switzerland since 1971, was moved to New York City this year due in part to growing protests in recent years at the Swiss Alps ski resort by groups opposed to the forum's agenda promoting corporate-led globalization. Over the years, discussions at the World Economic Forum have spawned the creation of controversial institutions such as the World Trade Organization and have supported free trade economic policies. Much as has occurred at other recent global summit meetings, thousands of labor, environmental, and student activists from the U.S. and around the world are planning to greet the elite delegates as they come to New York for the forum, with protests, street theater, and teach-ins. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Dolan, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the history of the World Economic Forum, the planned protests, and the concern that in the post-September 11th environment in New York City, police may not tolerate dissent and label those engaged in direct action as terrorists.
It's a ruling class caucus, essentially, Scott. It's an elite member-based institution. It's funded by approximately 1,000 multinational corporations. Some of them pay as much as $300,000 per year for the privilege. They gather in a sort of a clubby kind of an environment, and then they hatch plans that relegate or subordinate civil society values, labor, environment, sustainability, consumer, human rights, and all that, subordinate all those values to their bottom line geopolitical interests and their corporate interests. So that's what the World Economic Forum is. We'll be there, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. A lot of different organizations are mobilizing to confront the World Economic Forum there. We certainly expect the top brass of the Bush administration to go to New York to be a part of the welcome, a part of the discussions. Bush and Cheney, O'Neill, probably Robert Zoellick, the United States Trade Representative, and we're going to take the opportunity in the streets of New York and in parallel fora in Manhattan to describe our critique of the World Economic Forum, but also to petition our government for the redress of grievances relating to the very neoliberal economic model. So we will be there, and I encourage your listeners to mark your calendars for a few days of critique and to proclaim our critique loudly to the press and to the policy and corporate elites in New York City.
Now, Mike Dolan, you described the decision by the World Economic Forum organizers of coming to New York City as a brilliant PR strategy.
Yep.
Do you mean that there is some thought on the organizers' part that the protests that they've encountered in Switzerland may not be tolerated or permitted in New York given the tragic events of September 11th?
That's exactly what I mean. I think they've really in many ways set a trap for this movement, for the anti-globalization movement. And all the summit stalking that's gone on since the battle in Seattle over 2 years ago against the World Trade Organization, there's always been some rowdiness, some property destruction at the periphery, requiring police to chase protesters and, black-clad anarchists, around and all the rest. Well, by going to New York in the aftermath of the events of September, at a time when really the New York City Police Department is incredibly popular and nationally, even globally, it creates the opportunity for enormous sympathy for them having to deal with protesters, and it could have the effect of further marginalizing the anti-globalization movement. So it's imperative for us to maintain really peaceful, explicitly nonviolent protests. No less dramatic, no less creative, no less militant, but in no way should we try to engage the New York City Police Department. The press will marginalize us. The corporate elites will marginalize this movement. And after the loss on Fast Track, that very narrow vote on Fast Track, after the launch of the World Trade Organization ministerial in November, and certainly after the events of September, it could be a public relations catastrophe for this movement to get further marginalized. It's very important that we get out there and prove that we're as broad and wide and deep and sophisticated a movement as we have always been, and that we do not allow ourselves to be marginalized by the mainstream media.
Mike, when it comes to the goals of the opponents of the neoliberal policies and the work of the World Economic Forum, what are those goals? What do people want to accomplish? What's the message they want to send out?
First of all, there's going to be a lot of noise about the war. The basic critique obviously being that it is in fact the real-life effects of the neoliberal model. The social injustice, the growing income gap globally, haves and haves not, that has caused so much of the animosity towards the United States, for example. And so looking at the real causes of terrorism, of the war, making the link between militarism and the neoliberal model is going to be one piece of the agenda. Second, we'll be calling on those political elites to forswear a flawed and failed free trade model. Additionally, it's important that we frame our critique of the World Economic Forum and the neoliberal model within a context of the search for alternatives and what another world will look like. In fact, the local organizing in New York is gathering around this this notion of another world is possible. And the AWIP, Another World is Possible, the AWIP coalition in New York, arising out of the Direct Action Network and the Independent Media Center, as well as your usual collection of NGOs that look at this, including Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, will be having press conferences beforehand, panels and plenaries throughout, marches, vigils, and rallies on the street, and then, as I say, ending up with some summary events which will proclaim not only our critique of the World Economic Forum and its agenda, but also our search for alternatives, the alternatives that we are recommending to the policy elites as well as to the mainstream media.
That was Michael Dolan, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996. Or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tuck. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Denise Manzari, Harry Monat, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.